Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of IGN Unfiltered, our monthly interview series where I have the pleasure of sitting down with the best, brightest, most fascinating minds in the games industry. Today, I'm joined by Cam Weber, the Executive Vice President and Group General Manager at EA Sports.
Yes.
Cam, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. You have a really fascinating background in that, as you were telling me earlier before we came in, like you work in sports, but in games.
Yes.
And like almost nobody can say that.
Yes.
So. We'll sort of work our way to that, but I'm always curious. I love to start at the beginning and see. I mean, you're running EA Sports. You work out of Tiburon, out of Orlando there. But what made you want to get into the games industry when you got started?
Sure. You know, I mean, I didn't grow up dreaming of working in the video game industry. It never even crossed my mind. But I did grow up gaming. I played games from a super early age, and
yeah.
I loved games. And I think it's also my competitive personality. Myself and my friends, as I grew up, more and more got deeper into games. And you know, the times when I was most engaged in games over the years was when I was playing on the couch competitively, you know, for bragging rights, the rivalries with my friends.
Yeah.
That's what really kind of got me into it. And so I always loved it. And as I went through the years and went to college and I ended up being I was a college football player.
I was going to guess receiver.
Yes, but, no, I was a quarterback.
Kind of like tall, lanky thing going.
Yeah.
So yeah, quarterback works too.
And so as I came out, I knew I always wanted a job in sports. And I actually, you know, went to school for business and I graduated with a finance degree.
Yeah.
And I ended up taking a job wearing a suit every day. I had a finance job for a couple of months and I wasn't exactly happy in that role. And then I got a phone call out of the blue from my old football coach from our college. And turns out there's a development studio in Vancouver at the time called Radical Entertainment.
Yeah.
And they had made a hockey game called NHL Power Play that was really good. And they were looking to branch out to other sports. And they had a new publishing deal. And they wanted to make an American football game,
yeah.
NFL game. And so they were interested in talking to me about maybe coming in and consulting around making a really authentic American football game. And so I ended up just out of curiosity. I showed up and I was told that if I came and I took this job, I would own the player database for all the players in the NFL and I would own their attributes and I would study the teams and what they did. I would design the playbooks.
That sounds better than the
suit amazing.
Job,
oh,
right?
Yeah. I'd be designing kind of these playbooks and the AI and the animation and everything that was taking place in the game. And I didn't know where it was all going to lead, but I said, I'm in. And
That's awesome.
I took this job and I learned to design sports games and did that for a few years and then ended up growing into a producer and an exec producer and a GM over time. But that's kind of how I got started. I kind of fell into it to go start working on sports games through my love of sport.
That's cool. So you effectively, I mean, I guess would it technically be gameplay designer? I mean, if you were
yes.
doing the, yeah, I mean, that's,
yeah,
you were
was,
able to leverage that, all that sports knowledge
yes.
in your head from being, you know, a sports fan and of
yeah.
course playing in college that how cool is that?
Yeah, it was amazing.
That's awesome.
And you know, in that game, that football game, we never even finished it because of changes in publishing deals and all these things. That game
right.
never shipped, and I ended up going and working on a hockey game and then a basketball game, and then we eventually got out of sports altogether and started making non-sports games. And by then, I'd been through a few development cycles. I kind of learned how games were made
yeah.
and how the design process worked. My natural kind of tendency being a quarterback and a captain of all the teams that I was on growing up, I ended up, you know, being someone I think felt really natural in leading teams.
Yeah.
And that cohesiveness of a team knowing what they want to accomplish and working together seemed to come natural to me. So I ended up becoming a producer and leading a lot of different types of games over the years before coming eventually back to sports at EA Sports years later.
Yeah, so one of those games you worked on, I thought your resume was fascinating. Simpsons Road Rage.
Yeah, yes.
We got on the graphic behind
yeah,
us here. But
I haven't seen that in a long
like,
time.
It was a pretty well-received
yeah.
game. Like, so I'm curious if you have any interesting stories behind the development of that game. Either, like, do you... When you go to make a Simpsons game, most people, and I don't know if you, maybe you can't think this way or you don't think this way, but I think the bar for expectations is kind of low, especially back then on a licensed game like that. Do you play other Simpsons games of and look at what not to do or what or take some cues, or do you just try to not look at anything else and say, like, what can we do with this? I'm curious.
You know, it was interesting. It was at a time when that studio, Radical, we were in a shift where we were making a bunch of sports games and branching out to do other sorts of genres. And so it was a combination of learning the Simpsons license and everything about it and watching tons of episodes and interacting with Matt Groening and Gracie Films and learning what was important to them.
Yeah.
And kind of distilling the essence of the license into a few kind of key understandings of what we knew we had to deliver on to make it a true Simpsons game. So it wasn't so much about playing prior Simpsons games as much as really investing in the time and energy to really understand what the license stood for.
Yeah.
And then understanding what we had to deliver on to really make it feel like a Simpsons game. And then on top of that, we had to develop a new driving engine, which I think we pretty much built from scratch back then, and learned kind of, you know, how we were going to build the game and build the world. We also built out the team at that point to make that game. It was a really interesting development cycle, and I learned a ton on it. And the thing that I really learned, especially in those years, where, you know, working as kind of an independent developer, where you're, every single game I worked on seemed to be a new type of game and a new genre with a new license.
Yeah.
Sometimes you never get that chance to really kind of get the ground under you and develop an expertise and become an expert on a particular genre. And what happened was, you know, I think we built that game and it came out. It was super fun. It actually sold really well. It was commercially a success for us. And then it allowed that team to then go on and actually build Simpsons Hit and Run, which actually was
probably regarded as the best game.
Yes,
game.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was a commercial success. It was a critical success. And once again, it's that story of a team that you build that starts to gel. And then eventually becomes great at what they do. And a lot of the lessons that I took from working in that era of my career, I use those and I see those in working with our sports teams today, which is, each team, they become experts on their space and their game, and they strive to just be world class.
The continuity is important.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, so I got to go back for a second, though. What were the key things that you distilled the Simpsons license down to that you had to get?
I mean, a lot of it is we had to get the humor right. One of the most valuable assets we had is just, I mean, that IP has the most amazing voice actors. And obviously we had access to the real Hank Azaria and Julie Kavner, all these amazing voice actors, the talent that these people had and their ability to, in the recording studio, go from one character and then just keep reading. I mean, Hank Azaria, I remember him reading.
Man.
He's talking about he's the Bumblebee man, and then he literally goes from one line to the next, and now he's a different character, and he just on the fly can adjust and just nail every single one of those characters. And so we wanted to build a game experience that would bring that humor, the mix of all of the characters in the universe, and use that voice acting of these amazing actors to the best of our ability. And actually, the construct of Simpsons Road Rage is one where you were picking up characters in your car and talking with them, and then picking up a different character in your car and talking with them, and you were over and over interacting with different characters on the fly with kind of one-off jokes and interactions, and it was very well suited to delivering that humor, the breadth and amazing characters that they had within the IP, and then, you know, obviously having gameplay that wasn't overly serious and was lighthearted and fun to play and challenging, but really allowed you to just enjoy, sit back and enjoy the content.
After the game comes out and it's fairly well received, do you hear from Matt Groening or Gracie Films or any of those guys afterwards with like a, hey, good job? Or, I mean, clearly you heard from them because you guys ended up doing another game with them, but I'm sort of curious what the aftermath of that looks like.
I mean, they are a licensing partner, and much like all the licensors I work with today, you develop a relationship and you meet with them regularly, you show them content along the way, they approve that content along the way. And then as you finish, you know, by the time we launched this game, I mean, they had already seen and approved all the content, and we were already into what are we doing with the next game,
right,
and starting to talk about how we evolve it from there. So it's just a continued ongoing relationship that we build and maintain over time.
Well, speaking of licenses, you were also involved with another highly anticipated licensed IP, Scarface, The World Is Yours, was a game that, as I recall, I mean, it was a AAA production. It had a big budget, big team behind it. This was not a, like some licensed games, again, that low bar I was kind of talking about earlier. This was not like a just pump and dump, let's try to cash in a quick buck here. Like, you guys made a real open world game with a proper story and the whole thing. What was working on that like?
Yeah, that was another big learning experience. You know, that's what when I look back, that's where I learned a lot of the lessons about what to do and not to do when working with a very large team. So, you know, I think the thing with game development, you can go from a place where you have a 20-person team that's tight and cohesive.
Yeah.
You have a ton of fun working together. Communication is easy and it flows every single day. And you get those kind of 60 to 100-person teams where that starts to become a challenge. And then you have to kind of split up into subgroups within your teams and rely on leadership and communication among them. And then you get to teams where, you know, like on that project, where we pressed above that and we had a lot of people contributing to the project, and it becomes more and more difficult to keep communication and collaboration between the different groups together. And while that project was a real challenge, I think that project was over 3 years.
Wow.
We made a lot of mistakes, but we also did a lot of amazing things as well. And we're able to kind of bring it to the finish. And I just remember how much we learned from that project. And we had a ton of fun making it. And I think the game did some interesting things. And once again, as we kind of iterate and move on, I think it was one of those projects that really allowed that studio at Radical to cut its teeth on some of the giant open world simulation elements that you have to build and set up for an open world game to be successful.
Yeah, and I mean, Hulk Ultimate Destruction would come later, which was super well received. I don't think Al Pacino's ever done a game, and he did not, for whatever reason, participate. I don't know if he needed like another Brinks truck to back up to his front door, or what the deal was.
It was more just having a voice actor that was going to be, you know, excited and willing to come in and spend the kind of hours that we needed to kind of get all the content we needed. And there had been many years between when that movie had gone live and when the game was made, 20, 25 years later. So it was just the most viable solution at the time. So we found a sound-alike voice actor, did a pretty good job.
Yeah.
And he was able, I remember he was just able to, you could just ask him questions and he could just stay in character, and he was just nailing it with every single line as we talked to him. So, it was fun. It was a fun project.
So then you move on to EA Sports. You hook in with the Vancouver team up there. You're working on FIFA, some of their projects. Sort of moving more to now, I'm sort of curious, you know, in recent years, every EA Sports game, every EA game, has moved over to Frostbite technology. So I'm curious, you know, that's got to be a decision that goes pretty high up, quite probably to you, where you've got these successful, cohesive teams that are, they have their routine, making the sports analogy again. And was that a tough decision to say, hey, we want to get everybody on Frostbite? Was it a difficult adjustment for those teams to do that?
You know, this kind of went back to the point where Andrew Wilson, so, you know, Patrick Soderlund used to run our, what we used to be called the games label, and Andrew Wilson ran the sports label.
Yeah.
We kind of had two factions in the company. And I think by that point we had realized that consolidating on common engines and the benefits that come from that, and having teams contribute and build, kind of the rising tide lifting all boats.
Sure.
And at that point, we had the Frostbite engine that was fueling most of the games and the games label, and then we had a collection of technology on the sports side, which we kind of commonized and brought together within sports and called Ignite. Mm-hmm. And when Andrew became CEO and we unified all of Worldwide Studios, and we sat down and we talked about where the long-term benefits would come of having one common engine. And it wasn't just about making game development better and improving the quality of our games and the efficiency of what we can build, but it was also to allow us to build for the future so we could build like our data platforms and our kind of the network that links together all of our social features.
Right.
And all of our kind of online and network code that would fuel kind of our online experiences, and having big, large, shared common teams that would invest in those things and invest in security and everything that goes along with that, and our analytics and our analytics systems. It was something that we saw was going to be a great benefit to us. We decided to do it. We started with FIFA. And FIFA was...
Well, you start with the most successful game in the entire portfolio.
The reason we started with FIFA was for a variety of things. One, FIFA is also our largest team. They're probably our most experienced team.
Yeah.
It's also a team that had done the most work down the route of their PC architecture. Which actually made it the most natural fit to get to Frostbite.
The transition.
First. Yeah. And then we worked on Madden. We were at Madden over last year. Another heavy lift. But it's something we do over multiple years. So we started with a group of people, 3 years earlier doing the initial port. And then in year two, it's a heavier lift. And then by year three, we switch everyone over and spend an entire cycle on the new engine. So we're chipping away at our other EA Sports games with the goal of getting, all of our titles over at Frostbite in the next few years.
So it's almost, to stick with the sports analogy, it's almost sort of an on-the-fly rebuild of these franchises from at least a core technology perspective.
It requires us to use advanced teams, which is a construct that we've used in sports for many years, where we have a team that's building this year's game, but we also have people that are working on technologies and innovations for the future at the same time.
Yeah, I remember when the 360 was coming out, and you guys, I think, either a launch title or a couple months right after, like NBA Live came out for 360, and it was clearly all brand new when there was still, and you had the PS2 original Xbox release as well. So
we have to use the kind of that advanced team methodology. Otherwise, it's really difficult to build big disruptive things, especially where they require new technology.
I mean, I think something that I try to mention this from time to time because I talk to some sports developers here and there, and I feel like sports game developers have what may be one of the hardest jobs in the games industry, in that they effectively have, between pre-production and the sort of the testing certification process, is it fair to say that the cycle is really about 9 months? Between the major annual releases, obviously they're updating content all year long, but that's about what it is, right?
We try to have our creative in a really good place for the following year going into the summer. So prior to launching Madden the next few weeks here, we have a pretty good idea of what we're building for Madden next year.
Yeah.
But we leave some room within kind of that capacity and schedule based on the response that we get from fans of the current game. We also have a kind of good idea of where we're going long range with each franchise. So we have to, in these annual franchises, you have to put a premium on long range planning for our creative. So we have to look at, where our consumers are going in the gaming industry, what experiences they want, what kind of our insights are telling us from all the research we do. And we kind of set like kind of a North Star for each one of our franchises where we want to go in the next few years.
So is it like literally in a job interview? Like, is it a 5-year plan?
Well, is it that far out? I would say it's more like a 3-year plan, but it's not exactly three. It's about where are you going in the next few years?
Sure, yeah.
And we're always kind of coming back to that. And we're always kind of reaffirming the direction we're going and making sure that it's the right direction, because things change our industry constantly. And it's not just for us. It's not just about the way that gamers are playing games. It's the way that sports fans are consuming sports content. I mean, I have a 10-year-old son who's about to turn 11, and he is a diehard fan of the NBA and the NFL, and he follows, the world of soccer as well. And I watch the way he consumes sports, and him and all of his friends, the world has changed from a place where you or I might follow a particular team all season long and sit down and watch a 3-hour game in one sitting.
Yeah.
And it's gone from teams to players and stars to following highlights and to consuming sports on multiple screens all the time.
Sure.
When James Harden did that filthy crossover step back last year and, you know, crossed over the defender onto the ground and he stood there for a few seconds and then dropped that
so
three. I mean, that moment went viral. Within 5 minutes, millions of people had seen that highlight all over the world.
Yeah.
And so we have to recognize that people consume sports and sports content much differently today than they ever did in the past. And so they're going to want gaming experiences that reflect that as well.
I guess maybe the opposite side of that example is like a couple years ago, daily fantasy sports was like the yeah. biggest thing
yes.
on the planet,
yes. yeah.
and now it's seemingly like gone.
Yeah.
Like their merger attempt failed, and you know, so is that the yeah. kind of thing where you might be looking at like, oh, okay, this is huge. How do we look at integrating this and making it fun in a video game sense, and then you know a year or two later, you're like, oh, okay, that's over. We can let's shift our priority to something else.
You know, I think it's an example.
Yeah,
but I think it's more, you know, things like fantasy scoring are interesting, and you know you're going to see something in our latest Madden Mobile launch coming on August 15th called Madden Overdrive.
That'll have already happened by the time this airs.
Okay,
trust me.
Well, you'll see in Madden Overdrive we just launched in the mobile space, where we created this great PvP experience that uses fantasy scoring rather than touchdowns and field goals.
Yeah.
It's all fantasy scoring for runs and catches and all that stuff, tapping into the kind of that love of that moment-to-moment gameplay in fantasy sports. But it's also in the way that people are fascinated with following real-world sports both on and off the field. So you're seeing it's about the culture and lifestyle. It's following your stars,
yeah.
not just what they did last night on the court, but what they're doing today in the media and in social media and how players are living the lifestyle within the sport. And people are fascinated by it, and they consume just as much of that content as what actually happens on the field.
Right.
And so it's creating experience, whether it's our career modes or our story modes or creating gaming experiences
yeah.
that are both, you know, on the streets and in on the court in the NBA.
Yeah,
I read in the news yesterday about James Harden and his debut at the Drew League.
Right.
Which is in a high school gym in Los Angeles. And that's just the way the world of sports has gone. So our games in EA Sports are evolving to create much broader experiences now.
I feel like I was at EA recently playing the One mode
yes.
in live. And I feel like
yeah.
that's hearing you say that, like,
yeah.
oh, the One mode makes a lot of sense
yes.
now after hearing you sort of explain the way the
yeah.
company thinks about it.
Yeah.
Really, I guess sort of a... Humor me for one more minute on the technology pipeline side, because again, with all these different teams working on totally different sports, but building off of the same core Frostbite technology, how does that sort of technology pipeline sharing work with that? Like in the sense of, does everyone add on to it? Like if the FIFA team makes a cool animation system, can the Madden team grab it or is it more of just do you end up with these just pretty individualized little branches off of the same core tech?
Yeah, so we have a large central Frostbite team, and Ken Moss, our CTO, is responsible for that group. And,
yeah.
And I mean, that's hundreds of developers, and they are in Sweden and in Vancouver and in Orlando and many other locations. And what they do is they invest in that core engine, and then what happens is they have various releases of that engine. And so as a team goes through their cycle, they agree to which version of Frostbite they're going to integrate with and launch on.
Yeah.
And so they work with the Frostbite team to integrate the latest version as it comes throughout each year. And then at a certain point in their schedule, they pick the moment where they say, okay, this is the version we're going to ship on. So we're not taking any more integrations from this point forward. And then they take the game, take it to the finish, launch it at polish. And then whatever didn't make it in, they then back integrate those changes into Frostbite afterwards. And so then that central team is constantly bringing in those integrations of new tech and features from all the teams into the latest central version of Frostbite. And then it's going out to the various teams that are using it as they take new integrations of the latest version of Frostbite.
Interesting. I'm fascinated.
So it goes back and forth, and
It's
very tightly organized and managed, and there's always challenges with this sort of model, but there are immense benefits to what our teams can do, where they can benefit from the innovation that happens across the company.
Right, and you don't have to pay anybody else for anybody else's engine.
Yes, that's true as well.
Too.
Yes, that helps.
All right, so you went to, you grew up in British Columbia, Vancouver area. You went to college there. So who's your favorite Vancouver athlete of all time growing up?
Vancouver athlete.
Not necessarily from there, but you know, who played, who made their name there.
Sure, I mean, I grew up a diehard Vancouver Canucks fan. I mean, I'm Canadian, so, you know, hockey was a sport that I grew up loving. You know, I used to listen to this, I mean, changing sports landscape. I used to listen to Canucks games on the radio in bed before I'd fall asleep every single night before, you know, on the night before school. But, you know, Pavel Bure, Trevor Linden, these guys were my heroes when I was growing up. You know, we then had, you know, an NBA team. We had the Vancouver Grizzlies for a while.
Big Country Reeves.
I was a bit more of a Sharif Abdul-Rahim guy myself. And I loved the Seattle Supersonics as well. So I was a Sonics fan and Xavier McDaniel and Dale Ellis, and then there was the Sean Kemp era, Gary Payton. I actually got to meet Gary Payton last year at an event, which was awesome. I introduced my son to the glove and got a picture with the glove. I was a fan of all of those sports. And actually, one interesting thing is my cousin is Shea Weber, who plays, he's one of the best defensemen in the world. Plays defense for the Montreal Canadiens in the NHL right now. And so I've followed his career as he's gone along as well.
Well, why not? You know, you're talking about the Seattle Supersonics. You know, hey, Nintendo has a piece of the Seattle Mariners. Let's talk to Andrew. Let's get EA
to help
get an NBA team back to Seattle. You know what I'm saying?
I like the thinking, Ryan.
They can play in the EA the EA Sports Arena.
That's a good
idea. Come on.
Yeah, I like that.
let's get it going.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so you were an executive producer, if I have this correct, on Fight Night Champions.
Yes.
That's on your resume as well. I'm a major Fight Night game fan. I will tell you, you talk about technology powering the games. I'm not a big boxing fan in real life. It's not a sport I really follow or watch. But when it came out, when Fight Night Round 3 came out for the Xbox 360, that was a generational, that was a, wow. Oh my goodness, like this is, and then I fell in love with the game after the graphics pulled me in. Yeah. So I followed the series ever since, and unfortunately it seems to be a bit dormant right now. Fight Night Champion, are we ever going to see that again? Or you know, UFC, I have to imagine, is a higher ROI. UFC is a bigger entity right now. Where do we stand with Fight Night?
Yeah, so, I mean, first of all, let me just say, Fight Night Champion, you know, if I had to pick one team and one game I've worked on in my career that I enjoyed the most, it probably was Fight Night Champion. It was such an amazing team. The core of that team is actually our current UFC team.
Yeah.
But the thing that was amazing about that game was talking about, like, I always love working on projects where we do something we haven't done before and we learn a lot from it. And that was the first, I think the first AAA sports game to pursue a full story mode. And so,
yep.
And we sat down at the start of the Fight Night Champion cycle, and we had just done Fight Night Round 4 and another phenomenal, critically acclaimed boxing
Absolutely.
Game. But we were seeing some decline in, you know, the commercial success. And the sport of boxing at the time was, you know, a bit in decline and well and having some challenges. So we sat down and we said, you know, how do we build and broaden the appeal of a boxing game moving forward? And if you actually look at, you know, Hollywood, you look at box office numbers, boxing is, it has mass market appeal in Hollywood. And so we kind of said, how do we mix kind of the Hollywood appeal of boxing with the kind of core following of what we've done? And it led us to say, you know, let's build a full story mode. And that's what we did with Fight Night Champion. Learned a ton. I loved that game. Like I said, I loved the team. And it was really a trailblazer. It was kind of before its time. Many years before a lot of the bigger sports games ended up integrating story modes later on. But, you know, that game came out. It's done well over time. But like you said, we had the kind of the explosion of the UFC onto the scene at that time.
Yeah.
And then we were able to acquire that license. And it just made sense to prioritize that at the time.
You're running a business
and
after
put this
all.
Team on UFC. And they've been doing that since then. We talk about it all the time, though, I will say. And we talk about, you know, what would it take to build something else with the Fight Night IP. I would not be shocked if we do again. We don't currently have anything in development with Fight Night.
Yeah.
But we're very aware of the following it has and that there is great equity in that brand. And it's just going to be picking the right moment sometime in the future where we can build another Fight Night.
Well, I feel like the right moment is if you can get that Xbox 360 moment, that launch. You know, we were hearing Microsoft's already talking about their new console at E3, like make it as a launch title for the next round of machines. Yeah. Well, that's my vote. I'm putting in my vote with you. I've got you here.
That's a great idea. That and the new Seattle NBA team. I'm going to take both of those back with me.
Those are free.
That's awesome.
It's fine. All right. So while we're talking about your EA Vancouver days,
sure.
I would be remiss if I did not also bring up SSX.
Yes.
That is you executive produced SSX. Fans want SSX back. You're not going to announce any projects while you're sitting here, obviously, but I guess what I'm seriously curious about is what goes into a decision like that either way? Like, so if somebody at the team brings it up, or maybe there's sort of a collective enthusiasm at the team of, hey, you know, when it gets up to you in the top of the ladder at EA Sports, hey, should we bring back SSX as just an example? What's the process when that question gets asked at the company of evaluating, like, okay, yeah, let's do this, or you know what, no, this isn't quite going to work. I'm curious about the process.
So first of all, let me just say, just because I want credit where credit is due, I didn't finish SSX. I worked on it for the first 2/3 of the project, and then I ended up moving down to Tiburon, and there was probably another 8 months after that when the team took it to the finish, and I think they did a great job of finishing that project off. But I also love SSX and loved that game. And, you know, we have talked about SSX. It's an IP that we own that has been beloved and has been successful in the past. And we do have a green light process within our company, especially when it comes to evaluating what we should fund moving forward. But essentially what will happen is if it's a sports game opportunity, if it's something small, if it's, hey, let's try to green light a couple of months of a few people putting together some conceptual
prototype
work or something like that, often that will come to myself and our EA Sports leadership team. We will look at, I have my budget and my kind of business locked in for the fiscal year, and we have lots of puts and takes and things we prioritize and move around during the year. And if we can look to fund an early piece of work, we'll find the funds to do that by moving around and prioritizing. And then once we get to a place where we might have something that looks like, hey, we've got a prototype and a pitch that could become real, then I'll loop in kind of our executives at a company level that will then, basically that's an ask for a bigger budget and a bigger investment for future fiscal years. And we'll go through that process and evaluate it and look at where it fits in the portfolio.
Sure.
And we'll have a lot of research that backs it up and all of those things. So there's definitely a process, but it's kind of a phased approach where we can do some things at a grassroots level within the studios before we need to ask to add it to the official SKU plan.
Right, makes sense. You can take little bets
here absolutely.
And there. All right, so 2011, you moved to Orlando to head up the Tiburon studio there. Yep. I'm curious, what is more pressure? Heading up FIFA, where you were senior producer and then executive producer, or heading up Madden? Which one's more pressure?
Well, when I worked on FIFA, it was my first year at EA, and really it was Andrew Wilson who was leading that up at the time, and so I didn't quite feel the full pressure at the time of running that massive business. So I'd say when I did go take on the Madden franchise, it probably felt like more pressure to me.
Yeah.
They are both high-pressure franchises, and Madden, while it doesn't have the size and reach of a FIFA on a global scale, when you just look at kind of its reach just within the United States and within North America, it's a very important game that and everything you do is under a microscope. So I think both are similar in that way. Both teams also need to iterate and ship games on a yearly basis. Both of them have very high-profile live services with an Ultimate Team that need to be driven day in and day out through the year, and we have the scrutiny of looking at the metrics every single day and how that live service is going. So I'd say there's a lot of similarities between the two, but with FIFA, there's the added complexity of the globalization and all of the different versions all over the world.
So you get the whole world mad at you if you screw FIFA.
Yes, exactly.
Mostly American.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Your job at one point also included overseeing BioWare.
Yeah.
At one point along the way, and you were in that position when a game called Shadow Realms was announced, and then about a year later, almost exactly, I went back and looked, it was ended up being canceled. Now, games get canceled all the time for various reasons, but the time is not usually that quick where it's like announced and then this isn't going to work. So did something change either with the project itself on that or with the company's priorities? Was it like seeing that the 4v1 mechanic wasn't really going anywhere? I'm just kind of curious. Yeah. You know, it's not every day that a BioWare project is publicly shelved. So I'm just sort of curious to know a little more about that.
You know, it's interesting. I actually came in and started working with the BioWare teams right as that was happening. And in fact, my first town hall meeting that I did in BioWare Austin,
right, where that game was
introducing myself. Was a week after that game was canceled. So I wasn't actually involved in the decision to cancel that game, but I will say that, as we start and stop various projects in the portfolio, it's always a variety of factors, and there's no one thing that causes a decision to be made. Some of it's priorities and resourcing. It's some of it that there's a need for resource where we need to accelerate something somewhere else, or we have a problem somewhere else in the portfolio, and we need to find a way to kind of move and push and invest somewhere else. you know, sometimes there's projects that aren't going well. That wasn't necessarily the case with Shadow Realms,
right.
But and we have to make the right decision to try and do what's best for the portfolio. So it's never easy,
sure.
Killing projects. I've done it a few times in my career. It's not a fun thing to do, but sometimes it's what's best for the studio or best for the company at that given time.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Pivoting more to a happier note, the EA Sports games, you talked a little bit about this. I mean, we've been seeing the introduction of these narrative-driven single-player campaigns over the last few years, and hey, they've been really good. Like, I think a lot of people are like, oh yeah, story mode and FIFA, that's charming. But no, it turns out they've been really good. So is it tough to innovate in the sports space where you've got this fixed set of rules and these fixed leagues and teams and everything?
It very much is difficult. I mean, I don't know if it's as difficult to innovate or it's difficult to build things that people see as innovation. It's a perception that we're constantly battling.
Right.
We have massive teams working on games like FIFA and Madden. We have teams working well in advance of the year that we're currently working on, our advanced teams that are building out and, you know, investing in innovations for the future. But because so much of the game, because these games are massive and so much of the game remains intact each year, and then we're often adding things or evolving pieces. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for those who want to say, hey, that's just, you know, feels a lot like a lot of the same, if you're not looking at the new stuff and enjoying those things, it's a difficult challenge that we're constantly facing. The story modes were one where I think it was just clearly something big and new, and it was a new direction for those franchises. And, you know, it was something that took multiple years to build. The journey took multiple years. Longshot was something we've been talking about for 4 or 5 years. Actually, when I came down in 2011 after building Fight Night Champion, my first meeting with Mike Young, who at the time was the art director of the Madden team, he's now creative director of Madden, my first meeting with Mike Young was like, all right, we're going to build something just like Fight Night Champion. We're going to build a story mode in Madden. We've been talking about it since 2011, and it's been just what's the right time. I mean, I think, frankly, in the years that followed that, there were too many other high-profile things that we very much wanted to do with Madden to get Madden to the place where we wanted it to be from a gameplay standpoint mm-hmm. and a mode standpoint. And then when the time was right and also when the technology was available in Frostbite, that made it a lot easier to iterate.
Sure.
And build cinematics and that sort of content and string it together. It felt like the right time, but it was difficult. I mean, a lot of learning, especially in the first versions. And I think, with each iteration, our teams are getting better and better at the storytelling element.
With gaming becoming more service-based, you talked earlier about the way gamers are changing their consumption of sports, and thus you need to evolve the consumption of EA Sports games. You know, we see games in general becoming more service-based. You know, longer tails on these games. Is there a day coming where EA Sports games could be subscription-based, like a monthly thing, rather than paying $60 once a year? I mean, is that something that you guys have to weigh and consider and look toward the future on?
It's a conversation. We recently announced our Origin Access Premier subscription on PC. So now we have a frontline content subscription on PC that we're launching.
Yeah.
Or that we just launched recently. And as we think about our future and building out a content subscription, you start to think about content in different ways. And so I absolutely think that there's a future coming where all of our content is part of more of a subscription-based service. And at that point, you start to think about how you deliver content to consumers in different ways. And it's not just about every individual game necessarily being just part of a live service that's going all year mm-hmm. round, but it's also how do you fit in other different types of content. So it opens up the possibility of smaller games and smaller experiences. And it makes me think about the possibilities of kind of adding to our sports portfolio in the long-term future as well, where we can fill gaps where we're currently
maybe a little NBA Street revival?
I don't know, maybe.
I got to ask about that. Was that a Vancouver project?
Yes, it was.
It's been
a long time. But and also, there was an NBA Jam built out of Vancouver as well.
Yeah, remember that one. That was 360 PS3 era.
Yeah, and those are great games. And I think NBA Live, I think the team has done a great job of integrating a lot of street basketball into the overall experience.
Yeah.
And so we very much tried to focus on that and focus on building out that experience and integrating both the street and the league basketball into the progression there.
Talk about another gear shift here. The Ed O'Bannon lawsuit, you guys were very, very high profile. I mean, this was mainstream news, not just video game news. You know, this idea of should college athletes be financially compensated for their efforts on the field. And you guys were part of this, the Ed O'Bannon lawsuit. Is that lawsuit specifically why, nobody forced EA to stop making NCAA football and NCAA March Madness, but is that where that decision stemmed from?
Yeah, I mean, I think at that time, well, like you said, it was just a massive story, this concept of college athletes and amateurism, and it was a much bigger story than just video games, even though the O'Bannon suit came from a video game, obviously.
Yeah.
But it was about, all merchandising and so on. And it got to a point where it was a huge conversation that needed to be resolved. We felt like at the time, all things considered, the best thing was to step away and spend a few years away from the business and allow the forces at play to figure it out and give it room to breathe with the hope that we either come out long-term with some sort of licensing model that we can then re-engage with, or have resolution on those discussions at a college and player and athlete level where we could re-engage with a level of certainty that not only are we treating all of those parties in the right way and interacting with that content in the right way, but also we need to be able to give our fans a level of authenticity that allows us to call it an EA Sports game and say this is authentic college football. And we currently haven't found a solution from a licensing standpoint that will allow us to do that. So we're still waiting. We're still having conversations. I would love to be back in the college football business. But we need to see things resolve in the real world.
Makes sense.
Before we can do that.
I mean, is it a case where do the lawyers say, well, if you keep going, we could be liable for a whole bunch more money later if this thing goes a certain way.
Yeah,
I don't know if
I'm
going to
comment
works,
on that, but it was too bad. I will tell you, I will never forget the day that I had to stand in front of the Tiburon studio and break the news that we were going to stop building our college football games. And I kind of felt like we ripped the heart and soul out of the studio that day, and we had to kind of rebuild it from there. And Tiburon as a studio, the college football franchise was just something really special.
It was highly rated,
yeah.
And a lot of. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, not to disparage the Madden team anyway, but I remember it being where a lot of the cool features that you guys would do in football would originate in NCAA.
The NCAA team was just a tightly knit group that just absolutely loved college football, and they would wake up every morning excited about coming in and making that game, and they fought to try and make their game different. You know, Madden was the big commercial kind of behemoth at the time, and so they went out of their way to make it different and bring the college atmosphere, the pageantry, the tradition, the unique kind of play styles of each team, and introduce some really cool game mechanics as well that really kind of brought out that college game and made it different. It was really something special, and I hope someday we can go back to making those kind of games.
So when you do have to break that news, and when you lose, you know, again, looking at it from a business perspective, you have lost, by your own choice, yes, but you have lost a revenue stream at that point. So what does the company do at that point? Do those resources go into, like, Madden specifically with that team? Do you sort of seed a bunch of other little projects or ideas or things? So what happens?
So to your point earlier about kind of new games and pitches, and, you know, we always have kind of a list of opportunities that are prioritized that we'd love to get to, that we don't quite have the resources to build. So at any given time, there's always a variety of things that we would love to get to if we had the resources to do it. So when something like that happens, we look to what those opportunities might be. And actually at that time, that was right after, I think, NCAA Football 14 was the last one we shipped. We were seeing the emergence of kind of the mobile category and mobile sports gaming. And actually, as we stopped building NCAA and we were able to kind of strengthen and consolidate talent within the studio at Tiburon, we were also able to go bolster the team that was working on Madden Mobile. And we hadn't been successful yet in really breaking out with a Madden Mobile experience. And we were able to put an amazing group of people together with some people that were already on the project, and we put this all-star team on Madden Mobile. And then that following fall, we launched Madden Mobile, and the game broke out. And in fact, I think Madden Mobile that year generated more revenue than the NCAA football franchise had, wow, the year before on console. So, that, you know, it's an example of where, you know, you can shake things up and sometimes something bad happens, but it turns into something big and successful.
Yeah, talk about lemonade out of lemons on that one.
Yeah.
All right, let's see. In fact, that's actually the next question that I wanted to ask you about mobile versions. I mean, most of the EA Sports titles have mobile versions now. How do you sort of look at those when... Are you trying to engage the same customer that would be buying the console versions, or do you look at the mobile titles as sort of their own separate platform, separate audience? I'm sort of curious from a top level,
sure,
organizational perspective how the mobile versions fit.
Yeah, I mean, I think we often think about it more in terms of gamer motivations and what they want to get out of an experience on each platform. And so we try to think about what gamers want on the mobile experience. And so, you know, when we kind of design what we want to do with something like Madden on the mobile device, we try to think about, you know, short, little, tiny chunks of experience, a small download that's easy to kind of pick up and download and play up front. We think about things that are rewarding and social, that have great elder games that keep you playing day in, day out. So it's different patterns of behavior with how they engage with those games.
Yeah.
And in fact, and I think the Twitch gameplay itself is much lighter, and there's a lot more that the game's doing for you, and then you're,
sure,
lightly interacting as much as you want to. But what we've actually found is we do have a lot of common players. We have a lot of players that are playing both our Madden mobile game and our Madden HD game, for example. We see this in our other franchises as well.
Mm-hmm.
But they're using them for different things. They're satisfying different motivations. Madden Mobile might be something that you play while you're on the bus or you're, doing something in between meetings at work,
right,
or walking to your next meeting on your phone. Whereas the HD version is something you do when you have time to sit down and have a really immersive experience on a bigger screen. So it's just different motivations, building the best experience for the motivation of a player and what they want to do on each individual platform.
Makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
Here's a fun one for you. When Tiger Woods runs into, let's say, image troubles, and your company has a very successful, very long-running partnership with him and his brand. What's the initial reaction? Is it like head in the hands kind of thing, or do you just kind of immediately go into like, okay, how do we deal with this? Like,
Well, without commenting on Tiger specifically, I think, you know, we are constantly, I mean, we're in the world of sports licensing with a lot of the things we do, and so we often will have situations that come up naturally throughout all of our franchises every once in a while. Whether it's a player we might have on the cover that something happens with in the media or, something like what happened with Tiger. And,
yeah,
you know, the first thing we do is we sit down and we talk about it and we get the facts and we try to understand, you know, what happened and what drove the incident. We kind of go back to our own values as a company and what's important to us. And we often involve a lot of people in that conversation, right? Up to, you know, Andrew as
our
CEO.
We talk
about these things, and then we decide what's the right thing to do, and we try to be open and honest and transparent with what we do and why we did it, so that everyone understands where we're coming from. But it's not always easy. But once again, we just try to like use our moral compass and values as a company to guide us.
Right.
With what we do.
And we noticed that Tiger did not last on the cover of EA game the golf game for much longer after that.
No.
Couple last questions for you. Your position has in the past been a stepping stone, to the position of the CEO of EA. Is that your 3-year plan?
No. I think that was in the case of Andrew. I think Andrew Wilson's an extraordinary individual with amazing talent and intelligence, and I think he was bound for that kind of role in his career. I will say myself, I love working with development studios and development teams. Working with and leading teams and studios and people, that's my calling and it's what I love. And I love being close to sports. And I was telling you earlier, I feel like I have one of the only jobs, executive jobs in the video game industry where I also am a sports executive at the same time, which is kind of my dream growing up. And so I love my job too much to even think about doing something like that.
All right, last question. I could not sleep at night if I didn't ask you this.
Okay.
And this is going to be a serious question, by the way. We're not talking about the EA Sports Arena in Seattle, although that would be cool.
Yeah,
if you guys get
the
basketball back in Seattle.
That's great.
So I'm a lifelong baseball fan. Baseball's in my blood. MVP Baseball 2005 is... I think it's still the greatest baseball game ever.
Awesome.
I mean, MLB The Show is fantastic. So MVP Baseball, is it ever coming back? Is EA ever going to make a major league game again? Because, you know, we knew why it went away. There was a contractual situation there with a competitor. That is no longer the case. So from the top here, the head of EA Sports, seriously, like what... Does it come up? What's sort of the thinking at your level behind looking at baseball again?
Yeah. So the answer is yes. We are constantly talking about the sports that we're not in. When we talk about the long-range future of our company, we talk about a content subscription and the gaps that we might have in our portfolio. I would love to have a baseball game in our portfolio. And it's something that, once again, every couple of years, we take a look and we talk about it and theoreticize about like what it might look like to get back into something like baseball. But I will say, you know, the game that the team in San Diego have built, and it will be there, it's a fantastic game.
Oh, it sure is.
I play it. I play the show every single year. I play it with my son, and we play it at home. And it's... it's a great game, and I think anyone who wanted to come in, and that's the thing about sports, when you want to try and take down an entrenched competitor, it's difficult, and it takes many years.
But you're trying to do that now on the NBA side.
Yes,
so you're clearly not afraid of that challenge.
No, and I think on the NBA front, I mean, basketball is a strong and growing sport.
That's fair.
Right,
global
now.
Market
it's
is
a
what baseball
tremendous
is
opportunity.
Not as global, let's be honest.
And so, you know, it's not necessarily that we, you know, won't be in baseball in the future. It's something we talk about along with a lot of other sports that we talk about constantly. It's more about prioritization, going after, you know, the biggest opportunities with the resources we have, and kind of looking at opportunities we might have long term as well to try and fill some of the gaps in the portfolio where we can, where... in future models and business models, we might not all be competing in this AAA $60 console space.
Right. Well, you guys have had a strong partnership with Microsoft for a while, and there are a lot of Xbox fans who go hungry in baseball department. So I will speak for them and say we want MVP back.
Okay.
But Cam Weber, thank you so much.
Thank
I appreciate you.
You
sitting down here for the last hour or so talking to me. I learned a lot about your career. I mean, I think you have a fascinating job, and I love the path that you have taken to get here.
Yeah.
I think it's awesome. So, Cam Weber, the top dog at EA Sports, officially the Executive Vice President and Group General Manager. I do these IGN Unfiltered interviews every month, so be sure to check back every month. They're on YouTube, IGN, iTunes. Check it out. We've got 30-something other episodes. I'm Ryan McCaffrey. Cam Weber, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll see you next month.
Right.
Hey, I'm Jillian Clare, the host of the podcast Thanks for Coming In. I've accumulated some pretty crazy audition stories over the past 20 years, and so have my friends.
And I was like, you know what? No, not going to do this.
And then Disney calls and is like, we need you to come test for the Ant-Man movies.
I didn't know if my scene was going to get cut or not.
Ooh, I could play that.
Tune in every Thursday to hear your favorite actors tell the funniest, saddest, and most cringeworthy audition stories. Sometimes even the one that got away. Thanks for Coming In is available on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.